district that doesn't have a Title I school. The allotments to our different school districts are based on the number of students in each attendance area that are living in poverty, and the allotments, the annual allotments to districts range from about $7,000, almost $7,600 annually, which is a small amount, to the largest allotment to one of our school districts, which is $10,425,000. So that helps paint the picture of the scope of Title I. Title I funds are used primarily to improve the educational process. That means they can be directed towards academics, reading and math. They can be directed towards school climate activities. Title I under ESSA and moving away from No Child Left Behind, which was a very top-down delivery of what you will and will not do. ESSA returns a lot of the ability to guide school districts and to create spending guidance for districts back to the states. We see that as a big win because it's contextual. You know what reading programs are used in the state, what math programs are used in the state. You know what the department knows what the needs are, as opposed to Washington dictating to 50 different states. We plan on immediately upon submitting our plan, starting on the guidance for our districts, because we will provide guidance regarding how to spend their money in Title I. Title I also requires an accountability system. And instead of annual, No Child Left Behind required adequate yearly progress. Everyone on the Education Committee, I'm sure, has heard of that. If you didn't make the bar, you didn't make adequate yearly progress, your school was labeled. We are now, as a state, allowed to make our own long-term goals and our interim measures. So that's part of the process we're collecting stakeholder feedback on, and that will be included in our plan. I'd like to pause now. I'm happy to go deeper, but if there's any questions.
Just given the spot where you stopped, I will ask a question about assessments. It's my understanding that another distinction between ESSA and the prior form of the federal legislation was that under NCLB, there had to be a single summative assessment, and that ESSA gives states the flexibility to perhaps have multiple statewide interim assessments that are added up to a single score. So if that's the case, I'm wondering to what degree you and your department have considered this notion of using multiple interim assessments that you aggregate into a score.
Right. In the section on Title I that pertains to assessments, the states can apply to participate in a waiver
innovation
process, an innovation waiver process to be allowed to move in that direction. In order to be accepted into that innovation waiver, a state needs to demonstrate that they have incubated such a process long enough in a small local level that you could bring it statewide and sustain it. So we're keeping a really close eye on this because one of our states that we collaborate with frequently is New Hampshire, and New Hampshire is in a consortium with us around our assessments. So we actually purchase our current assessments collaboratively with a number of states in New England, a small number, because there's only a few of us, but it helps us, and New Hampshire is one of them. So, for instance, New Hampshire's plan is likely, they're still working with their stakeholder feedback, too, and they'll share their plan with us when it's ready, but it's very likely that New Hampshire will apply for that innovative space. And what they moved toward last year in their 2015 flexibility request was getting permission in three small school districts to pilot a program that allows for those three districts to take the state test every other year, and on the off years do kind of a portfolio, interim-based assessment. So they've now had that system in three small school districts to incubate it, kind of, and keep an eye on it. And then they're going to, I believe, be applying to continue that with the idea that it would eventually go statewide. In order to be approved New Hampshire or any other state that wants to go into that zone will need to demonstrate that they have the capacity in a number of ways to sustain such a program. And the capacity, you know, they would still have to do peer review tests sort of in the off years, you know, that sort of thing. So they would still have to meet the federal requirements. And then they'd have to demonstrate that the instruments that they're doing otherwise also meet those requirements and things like that, and also that they have the fiscal sustainability to move in that direction and that they could do it statewide. We are excited to see some of these innovations. We think they will be in alignment with the board's emphasis on personalized learning and more of an approach that can be tailored. And we certainly will stay close to our states that are more poised to take advantage of that innovation than Connecticut is right now.
And if I could just share, there is no additional funding. So it was a huge amount of enthusiasm around innovation and assessment. And then states learned that they won't get an extra dollar for it. So it's an awkward place because you'd have to grow it and try to sustain it using state funds.
Right.
We do have assessment funds.
And I think that a lot of states will be keeping an eye on the states that feel they can move in that direction, and also look at the data in New Hampshire over the next few years to see how it goes. One of the other key components around being accepted for such an innovation would be demonstrating how our track record is on reducing achievement gaps and things like that. So there are thresholds to meet.
Thank you. And just to follow up, so it sounds like we're doing a lot of things in partnership with the state of New Hampshire. Do we have the ability to leverage the efforts they're undertaking in our state if they prove successful? Might we be able to essentially, emulate mm-hmm. the portfolio approach that they develop and move in their direction without incurring the same level of cost that they and other innovators might be incurring?
I think that's a great question, and it's something that we're keeping an eye on. One of the great opportunities that's already, I think, been really true in the last several months, almost a year now, under the lead-up to ESSA and now the work at the state level, is the amount of collaboration going on among states now is really incredible. People are really sharing ideas. I was very proud to represent the state this summer at a gathering where I got to meet with the staffers from the HELP committee related to our accountability system. In Connecticut, over the course of the two waivers we sought, and particularly in the 2015 FLEX request, we received permission to have an accountability system that goes beyond test scores, and we're really proud of that. And so our accountability system that we've now used for 2 years weights equally growth on standardized test scores and the status measure. It actually weights growth even a little more than the status measure, which I think is really good. It also allows for indicators beyond test scores to be included. So our accountability system has 12 components now rather than just being made up of the single test score.
It's in the folder.
Oh, good. And we have a copy of it in the folder for you, so you can find it in there. It's our two-pager on – we aim at one-pagers, but, you know, we're educators, so we end up with two-pagers. But it's our FAQ on the accountability system. And there are 12 indicators in our accountability system in Connecticut. And so one of the indicators that goes beyond test scores is access to arts programming. And over about 3 years of public engagement around how do we know what's a great school, how do we know what's a great district, one of the things that we heard loud and clear is that in Connecticut, people really value access to arts programming and want that for every child. So, and we know that in the No Child Left Behind era, this is one of the subject areas that may have been inadvertently squeezed out of the curriculum. So arts access as an indicator of school accountability and district accountability is something that clearly Connecticut residents and stakeholders to the education felt very strongly about. So we got permission to include that. It's data we already collect anyway. Similarly with physical fitness. It's data we already collect from our districts anyway with the presidential physical fitness exam, so we were able to use that as an indicator of the holistic health and wellness of our kids, and we received permission to do that. In addition, we're working with chronic absenteeism as an indicator of engagement in our schools, and we're seeing great reductions. This year in particular, we saw a huge reduction in chronic absenteeism in our schools, and districts get points in the accountability system for being, you know, below the state average and that and chronic absenteeism and that sort of thing. So that's this kind of accountability system that we were able to develop as part of the flexibility work, the waivers with the federal government, has now become a model. So a lot of other states are consulting with Connecticut as they try to develop something that goes beyond test scores and incorporates these more nuanced aspects of what makes a great school and a good school and a good district. One of the things that the U.S. Department of Education does still somewhat favor is the measure of what percentage of kids get to proficiency on the test. But we do think that because of what's permissible under ESSA and because now we have a good track record of having 2 years with a more nuanced accountability system, we think that we will be able to defend an accountability system that that includes growth and where every point of student growth matters. So that's something that we heard a lot about from our stakeholders, and we think it still meets the criteria. I think we'll be able to also defend that we are holding our districts and schools adequately accountable while still moving away from the status measure.
Thank you. I believe Representative Laviello has a question.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Nice to see you both. Just a quick question. I feel like I should know this, but I have actually no idea. The $115 million that Connecticut generally gets that you mentioned, how is that, in what form or under what rubric is that passed through to the districts? Is it part of ECS? Is it separate Title I funding? What is it?
It's entirely separate. We have Title I grants. Mm-hmm. Districts apply annually for their grants.
Okay.
And that money is delivered in a very separate stream.
So it's allocated competitively?
No, not at all. It's an entitlement grant.
Oh, okay.
And it's based on census data, poverty census in different attendance areas. And I should mention that also applies to both private and public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Not every private school applies for it. But many of the parochial schools in Connecticut, if they qualify to have Title I funding, they receive a small portion of that directly from the town. It's added to the town amount, and they receive it as well. But it's all driven, it's all sort of pre-boxed up in census data.
So the amounts are formulaic, but the process for the grant approval, that's where the biggest policy decisions are, because in the grant approval, what is allowable expenditures under Title I currently has been very narrow. So in the No Child Left Behind era, generally, and this is a bit of an overstatement, but generally it was related to math and reading education. So allowable expenses might have included resources related to that. This broadens and the possibilities for how what kind of guidance we might give our LEAs around their school improvement efforts that are targeted towards students living in poverty. One of the most important rules about Title I is often referred to as supplement, not supplant, and the efforts, the money that goes to districts must be in addition to the money that the district would normally spend on the education of all of the children, and needs to be targeted toward the efforts, particularly with children living in poverty.
And in terms of the criteria that are used to determine whether a school is serving people in need or whether the school is in need, I guess two questions. Is that determined by the state or by the federal folks? And also, are those criteria in any way aligned with the way that we allocate our ECS funding to determine poverty and need?
I can speak to, and that's a really interesting question you're raising, because it is, we are provided with a formula we must follow. And so the state determines, the U.S. Department of Ed isn't calculating what Darianne gets versus what any Tom. Connecticut does that, but the formula is fixed.
So the formula is fixed by the federal government.
By the federal government. It's based, again, on census data and poverty and the poverty level. So it's really about attendance areas and census data. And I can certainly come back with more details on that, but I know it's a fixed assessment.
Yeah. Proxy for poverty that's used in the Title I formula is not the same as the proxy for poverty that's used in the ECS formula. And I could ask our fiscal office to do a deeper follow-up on Laura.
I would really appreciate that. I'd love to see what the differences
question.
Are and what their proxy is. Thank you very much.
So,
are there other questions from members of the committee at this point? If not, why don't you move ahead with some other titles?
We haven't moved from the slide, but we are moving down to Title II, which is really devoted to the development and support of teachers. I can say that historically in Connecticut, at least in, I'd say, the last 20 years in Connecticut, the vast majority of the funds we always, as a state, have tried to deliver to our LEAs. While we have it's allowed to hold back funds, we often think the funds are best used at the local level and programs are best designed at the local level. The vast majority, in my experience, goes to professional development at the district level. Although there are some unique ways that people can use funds, you could hire teachers for class size reduction. There's a whole variety of ways you could use it. Most districts that I know of are using it for professional development. It's a big cost, and it's important, and it might be used to fund substitute teachers, so teachers can come out of their class for an hour to meet with their grade level team, for a data team or professional learning community meeting. There's a variety of ways, but it's largely focused on that. To give you an idea of the size of this little pot of federal money, Title II, we receive about $21 million annually. The bad news is that, unfortunately, when the U.S. Congress was dividing up the fund nationally, Connecticut was on the losing end. We won in Title I. There are states that lost significant funding in Title I, but we're taking a hit in Title II. We'll be losing about $5 million over the next 6 years. And so it's coming down a little less than $1 million each year. So we'll probably, we'll level out around $15 million. That, again, gets distributed. We take very little except funding a position at the department to be able to administer this grant. And we will recommend, given that these cuts are coming, that we continue to just push it all out to our districts. And I'll take a moment if anyone has any questions about Title II.
In our stakeholder feedback, one of the things that we are making clear to folks, because a lot of people in the world are approaching stakeholders and saying, under ESSA, you can do this, or you can do that, or you can do this. And it is true, there's a lot you can do, and a lot you can do, particularly with Title II. You could have a principal's academy, or you could do this, or you can do that. And you can do all those things, but there's not any new money to do those things with, and in Connecticut's case, there's a lot less money. So we are trying to right-size expectations for our stakeholders when we seek feedback so that they don't have a wish list that, we can't fulfill.
And you will find, as the commissioner stated, that there's a lot of buzz around, like, oh, now we can use it for this and we can use it for that. But unfortunately, the money hasn't gone up. We will deliver those allowances to the districts to choose. Mm-hmm. For example, Title I, which I failed to mention earlier, can now fund preschool programs. Historically, it was a K-12 funding issue, but it can now be used at the pre-K for early learning. We know how important that is. that's not a decision that we don't think it's best, and we're proposing that we not make the decisions which how districts spend that money. But it's an opportunity. Combine that with some of the grants that come out of Head Start grants, you know, block grants, Smart Start grant, that they could combine federal and local funds to get a preschool program going, you know, universal preschool in the district. We leave it to them to decide that. So you'll hear sometimes people say, you know, what we can do with health, what we can do with fitness, all of those are possible. We're not going to be dictating from the state level. We're going to pass those allowances on to the districts. And again, there's not extra dollars to do what you were doing before with your title money and these additional things. But in certain cases, it might be a great strategic decision to now move in a new direction. If there's no other questions, I'll move on to Title III. Title III is for language instruction for English learners and immigrant students. This, along with our bilingual state grant, is the lifeline for English learners in Connecticut. It's our two major funding sources. Often these funds come into the department and we use them to support our students in a variety of ways. In terms of the scope of the funding here, it's about $6.5 million. We hold back a little less than 5% for administering the grant, but also for state activities that we think are critical. This includes statewide professional development. This includes teacher resources, which we work with the RESCs to provide. For example, I know the last time that I worked in a school, statewide, a flip book of ESL strategies went out, and every teacher in the state received a copy of it. And it was the beginning of helping teachers understand, and I'm talking about regular education, classroom teachers understand how to help and support English learners. That continues to be a challenge all across Connecticut, and we will continue to do that. We also fund from those two pots of money the Lost Links assessment. An English learner is identified in a district, receives direct services, and with the parent permission. The parent has to provide permission to receive services. And at the end of each year, we do an English language proficiency assessment called the Lost Links to determine whether students are making appropriate English language progress. I will say that under ESSA, English language proficiency has taken a very prominent role now in Title I. We, in fact, have to add it to our accountability system. If you look at the 12 indicators the commissioner mentioned, we will be adding English language proficiency as an important measure as well. Any unused Title I funds that are not used at the district level, we may use for things. For example, we have an ARC, an Accelerated Route to Certification program, to try to promote ESL teachers, English as a Second Language teacher. It's a shortage area in Connecticut, and so we're trying to find innovative ways to try to fill the ranks of those teachers. And through a course, cross-endorsement, ARCTEL, ACES runs that. It's actually been in existence for, I would say, close
probably
to a decade. Yeah.
And actually, every once in a while, we get one of those nice success stories. Through that effort with the Title III dollars that were repurposed to the ARCTEL, this year, for the first time in a decade, the TESOL certificate came off its shortage list. So it's not one of our top 10 shortage areas. That doesn't exactly mean we have enough of them yet, but it's helping us in meeting the needs for our teachers of English as a second language.
And I'll also share one of the commitments we've made as a department is we now translate parent materials that come out of the department into six languages. If you go to our website, you'll find Spanish is routinely, but we look at the top six languages, which include Portuguese, Haitian, a number of different languages. And that's a big commitment we've made, and a small amount. It's actually not as expensive as people think it is. But if the department absorbs that and provides that, district can just use it. And we don't have 169 towns trying to translate materials. We did that during the Common Core standards era and during the introduction of the Smarter Balanced Assessment. So we have reports to parents in six languages.
And Title IV.
Yes, Title IV.
My co-chair has a question about Title III.
Sorry about that. In terms of, you know, I appreciate the dollars. It's great to find out that TESOL is no longer a shortage area, although I think it probably still is. But having said that, one of the areas, as you know, we've all struggled with is minority teacher recruitment. I wonder, is this an area, is this there's so much money in this pot, there isn't. I get that. But it, would the law, if we were interested, allow for some funds to go towards efforts along those lines?
I think that's a really great point of feedback. And one of the things I should have said at the beginning is we do have someone gathering your questions and feedback, and there'll be lots of other opportunities, of course, for the Ed Committee to provide feedback and direction as well. One of the things with Title II, since Title II is about teachers and efforts around teachers, it would very likely be Title II, either for the state or at the local level. And some of our districts have done creative things with Title II funds. So I do think that that is an area where we can be creative with our Title II and in collaboration with our institutes of higher education as well.
Okay, so if you're telling me that some of our local districts have been creative with Title II dollars for minority teacher recruitment, if that's information you can get us, I think we would all be interested in finding out if there are models or things that are actually working here in Connecticut. I think that would be useful for us to know. Thank you.
Be happy to gather that for you.
Representative LaVille.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, you had talked about Title III and ELL, but is there some intersection as well with the minority teacher recruitment and people who are able to teach bilingually? You know, not training them, but actually people who have that qualification to begin with. They might come out of the same pie in certain circumstances.
Yeah. And that is a high priority area, of course, for the department and for our board. And the bilingual shortage is very acute. I think the TESOL shortage, while not one of our top 10, you know, we're required by the federal government to name our 10 shortage areas every year that are our most dire shortages. TESOL is an area where one of the reasons we particularly favor the advanced alternate route to certification program with the ARCTEL is that it not only gives kids someone who's certified in teaching English as a second language, it makes us a better teacher. So as a teacher of social studies, I become a better teacher for all my kids when I have those strategies because we now have English learners in all of our school districts. And the language diversity in Connecticut is so, as you know, I know you have a big interest in this, it's so many languages. It's not just, you know, right, so many. So it really makes for a better teacher. But bilingual education is still required in Connecticut in certain circumstances when the number of students of the same language group is significant enough in an individual school. And we do not yet have enough teachers, and particularly in languages other than Spanish, we do not yet have enough teachers. So in Portuguese, in Polish, in Arabic, we have a real shortage. So that's definitely an area where helping our talent office has developed a lot of work for districts around the idea of a talent continuum, and recruitment being a critical component of the continuum, both at the local level, but also in the pre-service component. So we are putting a lot of efforts toward recruitment. And districts might as well, with the local funds that they're allowed. And I think that's the kind of feedback we're looking for in terms of how much flexibility is the right amount now that states have the opportunity to do this differently and have a state-designed approval plans for Title I and Title II and Title III, within, of course, the bounds of the regulations, mm-hmm. which we are, you know, getting the regulations in an ongoing way, what flexibility should we give districts, and should we give all districts all flexibilities, or should this be a differentiated approach? So these are some of the key questions we have for you and for our stakeholders.
just on that topic, you know, I'm going to be having conversations, as I'm sure many members of the Education Committee are, with folks around Connecticut around what we can do better. But the notion of having a differentiated approach where districts that are high-achieving districts have plenty of latitude mm-hmm. regarding how they use their funds in Title III or Title II or Title I, and having clearer lanes and guidelines for districts that are underperforming by our state standards seems to me only logical and would seem to conform with the type of approach that we as a state have been promoting, which is to say, if you're a high-achieving district, we're going to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And if you're in trouble, we're going to be more prescriptive because it appears you're in trouble.
Exactly. Thank you. That's sort of there's a future slide that shows that exactly. That tiered approach is what we're proposing and embracing. I'll wrap up on Title IV, unless there's any other questions about Title III. Title IV, historically, it's called 21st Century Learning, and historically, it's funded with about $8.5 million after-school programming across the state. They have added a new section to Title IV. It's called Part A, Student Support and Academic Enrichment Grants. It's as yet unfunded. We have some disagreement at the federal level. The House had proposed $1.5 billion be placed into this fund for states, and the U.S. Senate proposed $300 million. So we're hanging in the balance. There was a tremendous amount of buzz and enthusiasm because student support and academic enrichment can be used to, say, fund students. First of all, it has to go to the most needy students, and that means both students that are in Title I schools from poverty and students that are struggling. So if, I'm sure you're familiar with our scientific research-based intervention model, which is we provide intervention to help accelerate growth among students. So you may have a student who's disengaging but very capable and would do quite well, and I'm using this only as an illustration, and might do very well on an online course at a very high, more rigorous course than is currently offered at the high school. You could use, for example, Title IV funds to help that student. So it's really based on it's needs-based. And they've, in many ways, kicked the door wide open. It can pay for career technical education courses at the school level. So you could, if you don't have a robotics lab, you could potentially fund your robotics lab out of Title IV Part A funds. It can also be used for support such as social work or psychological services, anything in the social-emotional realm as well. This is, again, the places where we'd want to do a tiered approach. And as you said, Representative Fleischman, so well, you know, the folks that are doing fine, give them as much latitude as needed. We will be developing a system for districts because we collect data routinely. We can actually assist districts through using our EdSite portal to find out which students have the most needs and who needs the most support first. So it isn't like districts are going to have to try to pick and choose who do I direct this towards. We have some data to help back that up. And so that's part of the system we're proposing that we'll be rolling out.
The thing about Title IV is in some ways, it's got a lot in it. It's got a lot going on. And so it's probably where the most flexibility is possible, but it's also not a lot of money. So I think that's also an important component to understand. But again, the feedback on this area in terms of what we should be thinking about is really important, and we are excited about some of the abilities that we have now and our local districts will have now that they didn't have before. On the next slide, we have one of the requirements of ESSA, which is not a new requirement but is a little bit different, is that we need to have an ability to identify our lowest performing schools and districts. So we have to be able to know which of our schools and districts need as what's described in the law as more comprehensive support and improvement. In Connecticut, this is something we've been doing a long time. It was also required under previous versions of the law, though it was more prescribed. So under No Child Left Behind, how states did this was actually prescribed by the federal government. So the states really just all did it kind of in the same way. Now, although they may have had different treatment options, the way they identified was the same. In both of our waivers, we addressed this, and we currently have a system for doing this. But we will need to have a system as part of our state plan with the federal government under ESSA that allows us to use a state design methodology to identify the lowest performing 5% of all Title I schools. And that would be due to either overall performance or student subgroup education group performance. We do this currently, and we have our schools that are identified as turnaround schools are absolutely lowest performing schools. And in Connecticut, we identify the lowest 5% of our Title I schools, but we also identify any non-Title I schools that come up in between that. You know, because obviously they need help too, even if they don't have the financial need. They obviously need some direction. That's what we've done previously, so I wanted to highlight that. Then the other group is called the focus schools, and that's where an education group is significantly lagging. And our what's referred to at the federal level as subgroups, and in Connecticut we call education groups, include all of the groups that we disaggregate our data for. For instance, our racial and ethnic groups, and also our students with disabilities, our English learners, and our students living in poverty. We also need to be able in our accountability system to identify which of our high schools are failing to graduate a third or more of students, so a graduation rate that falls below 66.6%, and Title I schools that have not improved within a state-determined time frame in greater than 4 years. Currently, under our current accountability system, those would be our level 5 schools, our schools that were in the lowest 5%, participated in an intensive program with the state, and still failed to progress in that. So some of those requirements are very similar to the old requirements, and we have a system by which we've been doing that, but we want to look at what stakeholders say about the system we've used and where it may need some tweaking. Some of the state support and improvement for low-performing schools that are currently allowed under the law would be the allocation of school improvement resources. It must be using evidence-based interventions. That's a really important point in that's new to the law. So previously, people could say, "Well, we're doing this approach," but the approach that they selected, there wasn't a check for whether that actually was likely. Based on evidence and research to make a difference for the kids. So now the approaches that are selected for school improvement approaches must have an evidence base, and that obviously then becomes part of our role in checking, that the things are selected.
And I'd just like to jump in and share that the department plans to provide tremendous guidance to the districts. I don't think it's a district's sole responsibility to go digging through research to find out what are the best approaches. So a way that we can harness our capacity within the department is to provide them with assistance. Now, that doesn't mean they won't pick up a program, that we haven't heard of or, an approach we haven't heard of, but we're going to try to provide as much guidance as possible across the subject areas, across school climate, and also lay out for folks it's almost being a good consumer. What qualifies as evidence-based? What qualifies as research-based? And because there's a lot of people out there selling things to school districts, and you've got to be a sharp shopper and be able to say this really doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
So in many ways, this helps with clarifying the state role in supporting districts and making choices. And again, we favor a differentiated approach on this. This is the most, this refers to the district, well, the schools in this case, that need the most intense and comprehensive support. So that's where the state's going to be the most engaged. One of the other changes under ESSA is around financial transparency, and that mirrors a lot of efforts here in Connecticut. So Kathy Dempsey and I are participating in some work to know what it will take for us to be able to do the financial transparency at the school level that's required under ESSA, and that's something that, as we understand that better, we'll be bringing forward as well. It is at the school level. So one of the requirements under ESSA particularly is that that the state has a role in periodically evaluating the equity of resources among schools within a district. So that is something that we have in Connecticut. We have historically had a role in. The way we have done it is not likely to meet the federal standards, so we will be learning how to meet the federal standards.
And there were regulations proposed that created quite a dust storm, kicked up quite a bit of dust, because it's onerous, the regulations that are currently proposed by the U.S. Department of Ed. Having looked at them and the commissioner commented on those, of course we want equity across our districts, but the district shouldn't have to spend 3 months trying to prove that they are distributing their funds equitably. So our objections are not to the principal, our objections are to, because we know what it takes to run a school district, this paperwork process. But looking at, again, and my understanding is in many states, they really do withhold local funds and sometimes even state funds from Title I schools because they go, oh, you get your money from the federal government. That's the planting, and that's really not okay. And so resource inequity is important to look at, and resource inequity also includes teachers and the salaries of teachers and the supports you give to teachers. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know. In struggling schools, often you have teachers that don't stay long. You might have a turnover, that sort of thing. That impacts the education. And so all of this, again, will be developing tremendous guidance. We're hoping the final regulations are a little less burdensome from the department, and we'll be trying to support our districts through that process.
Do you have, before we move on, any questions on the required school improvement plan?
Moving on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for your great presentation so far. I'm just interested in the distribution, and I know there was a question that we had asked previously about the distribution and comparison between the education cost-sharing grant and the Title I money, and I'm wondering if we could take a look at the formulas for both together, side by side, so that we'd be able to take a look and see how that works.
Yes, I'll ask Kathy Dempsey in our fiscal office to do kind of a one-pager that can help us understand conceptually how each works. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of conversation around that. so it's good for all of us to get as up to speed as possible.
I think so, too. And then just to follow up quickly, as you know, my district, Wyndham, has a very high percentage of students with a home language other than English. And I'm wondering how that will fit into the Title I. Is that also, is there an overlap in how you look at the funding for that, or there's no overlap?
In Title I, in the accountability part of Title I, we will be held more accountable than we have been previously for the progress that our English learners make. So we do need, as a state, we will be held more accountable, and we will be required to hold our districts and schools more accountable. That will be a component of that. In Title III, where the resource support really lives, that's the part that where resources come from the federal government and then we send to the districts to support the students that are acquiring English at the local level.
And there was a change a couple of years ago on how we allocated funds in terms of our ECS funding, and the English language learning portion of that, or the English, we have a home language other than English, there had been a change in how we do the formula, and that had been, I think, had been taken out of the ECS formula.
You know, I'm just sorry I don't know that, so we will look into that and try to learn about that question. So
okay, great.
I'm not clear on the relationship between English learners and the formula, so we'll learn.
Yeah, it was, I think that there was an alignment instead with the poverty level in the district as opposed to giving consideration to the numbers of students with ELL, which puts it in how the money is allocated in a different light. So that would be great to also have that. Thank you so much for all your work.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? If not, please proceed.
Okay, moving on. This next slide addresses what's called the Consolidated State Plan. The last time Connecticut submitted for No Child Left Behind a state plan was in 2002. In it, and I mentioned this earlier, identifying long-term performance goals are now a function of the state, and we're busy looking at that right now. Historically, under No Child Left Behind, it was every single year you did a progress check, and it was based on one thing, and that one thing was a test. And because it moved so quickly, this is anecdotal, but some of the things we saw happening in school districts is they were abandoning some of their programs or their potential things because it didn't create a big bump in scores fast enough. We want to be more thoughtful about this, and so are considering, and it's at the consideration level, long-term goals across a wide span of time with interim progress checks at a potentially a three-year interim. And the reason is because we just don't think 1 year you can measure growth. Anyone that's worked in a school knows you'd like talk about it and try to get it going the first year. Second year, you start to get better at it. And by the third year, you're really doing a much better job. This does not mean we are not urgent about our goals, but we're trying to be more thoughtful and avoid some of the pitfalls that we suffered under No Child Left Behind.
I'd like to add to that this is happening at such a perfect time mm-hmm. for Connecticut education because our state board in really very strongly taking a stand in their comprehensive five-year plan around four key promises to our kids couldn't have better anticipated the direction that this law was going in. And so one of the things that is perfect timing for the state education agency is we're in the process of developing how we'll hold ourselves accountable for delivering on the promises in the state board's plan. And this effort, we've been engaging with technical assistance with experts on what would be the best things we could pick to measure by and how will we know if we're getting better. So we'll be, within the next few months, presenting the board with a proposed set of metrics, and that comes at a really great time as well with regard to considering how we'll think about our relationship with the federal government and how we'll propose long-term metrics over the next beyond a decade, really.
And as an analogy, I see it as nesting dolls. The board plan, which is 5 years, sits inside the long-term goals for the state of Connecticut related to every student succeeds. And so there will be a natural breakpoint when the board creates its next plan, which will again continue as part of ESSA. We're allowed to make course corrections if we get parts of this wrong, but we're trying to be incredibly thoughtful and consider the needs of our districts. At those interim measures, if districts aren't making the kinds of progress they need to be making on three, I'm talking about ESSA now, on three key metrics, graduation rate, academic achievement rates, and English language proficiency, the department then provides supports. And I'm saying districts, but it's really schools. And I'm sorry because we often think in the district unit, but in title, it's at the school level. Now, I'll also tell you that many times the number of Title I schools that are struggling happen to sit all inside one district. So it's sort of, blended there. But if they're not making significant progress, that's where supports come into place. There may need to be retraining. There may need to be extensive examination of the use of funds. Depends on the district, depends on the needs. But we're developing a plan to address that.
Thank you. Senator Sostrick has a question.
Thank you. Within this long-term plan, I think it would be a subcategory, and I'm not sure whether it's more appropriate place in the accountability. I'm wondering where we can insert something in along the lines of school climate, mm-hmm. And where do we try to get our districts to understand that this is a really important piece of how our schools work, and it is very closely tied to academic achievement. Mm-hmm. So where, if anywhere, in this plan do you see that fitting in?
I think one of the things that, and I'm so pleased and honored that so many members of our board are here, and both our Chairman Taylor and our Vice Chair Hopkins-Staten are here, as well as several board members. In crafting the state board's plan, the first promise that the board made is ensuring that students' non-academic needs are met so that they'll be happy, healthy, and ready to learn. And that really is around mental health, nutrition, after-school programs, but really school climate is at the heart of it. We are really within in a lot of ways, the ESSA plan that we do with the federal government is really an agreement we make around what guardrails we're going to put around LEAs for the use of those federal funds. School climate will be an allowable school improvement piece under ESSA, allowable by the federal government. I anticipate that our stakeholder feedback will also validate that Connecticut stakeholders will want that to be an allowable expenditure under Title I. Also under Title IV, programs around social emotional learning. So there are a couple of key areas where this can be supported and therefore also kind of endorsed, because the ESSA plan really does a couple things. It really focuses the efforts in terms of the kids that need us the most, because that's who it's really aimed at. But then it also allows us to highlight what we think matters, what the state and what the leadership everywhere in the state thinks matters and will be good for kids. So that's one of the things we're under the No Child Left Behind era, because it was so targeted and things were left out, it gave the wrong impression that those things didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And people behaved as if those things didn't matter anymore. And we saw a reduction in arts programming, a reduction in efforts mm-hmm. around civic education and social studies.
And social-emotional learning.
And social-emotional learning.
Yeah.
So this is really a very important moment, and we're doing, and I have to really, again, credit Ellen and the team working very hard to make these efforts make sense together mm-hmm. so that this becomes an accelerant of our state board's vision for kids, and that school climate and social-emotional learning are very central to it.
And I do want to share that the three goals in ESSA are required by the U.S. Department of Education. We have many goals that are found in our state plan, that we have metrics that we'll be developing. So you may not see it as one of the three required goals by the federal government, but it is required by our state plan. And we'd like to keep the number of goals we have for the federal government limited to the requirements. I mean, again, that's what we're proposing. But our board plan extends well beyond that. And I do want to just take a quick moment to say we at the department, and most especially, not only, but most especially in our turnaround office, have devoted Alliance District convenings to the topic of trauma-informed practice, restorative justice. We're working on a set of social-emotional learning. We're actually calling it habits, because standard sounds like, you know, a kid isn't up to standards, and kids are both genetically and experientially who they are. And so we don't see them as standards. We see them as good habits we want to develop. That has gone to a committee of the board twice for kindergarten through third grade through a partnership with our early childhood colleagues. And we look ahead to having those adopted by the board and disseminated. We've already done a crosswalk with every subject area so that teachers don't have to think, where should I reinforce persistence? Where should I help students have a good sense of stick-to-itiveness or of self-esteem? We're actually looking everywhere where there's a natural fit. Again, doing a heavy lift so that teachers don't have to flip through all their standards to figure that out. What we do know is there's no more time left in the day, so how do we use our time best and efficiently? So there's some exciting things happening in the department, but I don't want you to think, because it's not visibly a goal called out in the ESSA plan, that it's not a high priority for us, because we couldn't agree more.
Okay, well, that's good to hear, and I don't have any problem with you keeping the federal standards. Our federal requirements to a limit, I think that's a wise way to move, but on the other hand, we wanted to make sure that I had mentioned that as a priority and an interest and something that, you know, I'm glad to hear that is included, and we'll look forward to your further responses in regard to that area.
Absolutely. Thank you for that feedback.
Thank you. I believe Representative Cook also has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And listening to all of our titles, I just have one question, and maybe you can explain, or just for the general public information, where does special education fit under any of these? If are they separate? Are they together? Where are they dissected? Because I hear us talking about regular education and different labels and titles, but special education, and we understand that it is a major issue. Does it impact effect here, or are we not talking about that in this at all?
Okay. The major federal law that governs special education is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, and that is a separate law that is also potentially up for reauthorization at the federal level, hopefully in the next session. And so that is the set of laws that governs that. Having said that, students with disabilities, which is the legal term that's used at the federal level for students who get special education services, are also included in these monies because they may also be affected at the schools that, you know, they may be there. So they are not funded entirely separately, you know, in that way, but the laws are separate laws. So this is the umbrella law over education in general and what we can do at the local level with these federal dollars. And then we have IDEA, which is the major federal governing law around special ed.
And I want to just clarify that my comment earlier about regular education might have just tripped something in your mind, but I was referencing ESL teachers have all the skills to work with English learners, but often our general education classroom teachers, especially if they've been in service for a long time, did not have an ESL course coming through their training. And so that's why we're looking to get, for English learners, all those skills. As we mentioned it, we also want those teachers to be completely skilled at working with students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. The beauty of ESSA is it's blind to whether a student has a disability or not. It's really based on poverty. And students are not excluded from programming. There's no reason to exclude them.
Thank you for that, because I think it's just vitally important, especially not just for us here, but people that might be listening or listening into the future, that they understand the difference, where people fall in what categories, and I hate the word categories, but, you know, what categories our students might fall under in the needs and, you know, the financial components that follow them. So thank you very much for that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. And I'll just continue to say that one of the requirements of our state plan is we discuss the guidance, we discuss the, you know, what we're calling differentiated guidance or tiered guidance. We also have a responsibility to monitor. Each Title I school must submit a school improvement plan to their district. We have a schedule of collecting them. We do not collect all 1,400 Title I school plans. We don't have the capacity to review them. But we currently have a system in place because a school improvement plan is not new. We also, a requirement at the local level is that they do a needs assessment. What does the school need? And so the department will be developing a couple of models of needs assessments, and we're going to, you know, reach out to folks with expertise in that area to make sure we do quick, efficient needs assessments, because again, principals and teachers can't all spend all their time doing needs assessments. So we want it to be a regular process. Both of those are periodic. And the commissioner mentioned earlier the resource inequities. That is also periodic. Thank goodness that is not annually, because that's a big job. So we are responsible for monitoring to make sure that the districts are doing their due diligence in terms of their requirements.
And this is our concept slide, and it's kind of our, you know, this is something we're seeking feedback on. And we've talked a lot about this already around a differentiated approach. One of the great opportunities of ESSA is that it allows states to come up with a plan that is not one size fits all for their districts or their LEAs.
Well, and I'd like to share, we have ed reform districts, which are our, by law, by statute, are our 10 lowest performing districts. 36 of our 40 lowest performing schools are found within the ed reform districts. And so it's important to know that there's a cluster of high need schools there. By focusing limited state capacity, and by that I mean we want to put together cross-divisional teams that go out to districts. So there's someone from our talent office who's traveling with someone from our academic office. Instead of working in silos and having a, you know, a visit for certification or for some sort of training around teaching, we'd like to have a cross-divisional team that one approves applications for our ed reform districts, provides high levels of guidance and access to what's working elsewhere in the state. One of the things that our new accountability system has showed us that there is tremendous growth in school districts that are struggling. There's tremendous growth in individual schools. Our commissioner refers to it as appreciative inquiry. If somebody's actually cracking the nut on our achievement gap for students with disabilities or for English learners, we got to go find out what's happening there, what's working, and then try to replicate it everywhere. We don't have the capacity to do that for all 30 districts and certainly not for all 169 districts, so we're going to use a triage approach, focus our energies on the bottom 10, give guidance and support, which is aligned very much to what we're doing for the other alliance districts. They still will get guidance. It will have more leeway than the bottom 10. And then all other LEAs, as you can see on the slide, receive very broad guidance. And so we're going to unpack what evidence-based means. We're going to unpack, but we're not going to list out for them, these are the best, you know, reading programs you could use. I mean, that's, those districts have far more leeway. But we're going to narrow the field for the schools that are struggling the most and try to direct all of our energies towards them.
And the place where the department primarily engages with the LEAs currently and in the future on this will be at the moment of their title approval for their grant. So currently the LEAs, and in the future this will occur too, the LEAs put in a grant, you know, proposal, and it's approved by our staff, and it's approved, and it's not automatically approved at all. There's a lot of back and forth and all of that. So what we're seeking feedback on, and this visual helps us explain it, is we're seeking feedback on using a differentiated system of both approval and also support, because currently all 169 get kind of the same from us when it comes to federal programs. And this would allow us to mirror what we've done with our state efforts in the last 5 years, where we've focused our efforts where they're needed the most. So this would allow us to treat our federal programs more like the way we've treated our state programs, where the state's efforts go where they're needed, and the folks that need a little more guidance get guidance, but not necessarily a lot of on-the-ground work, and the folks that are basically doing all right just get the guidance. So we hope that you'll be able to provide us with feedback on other thoughts on this concept, and also open to any other questions on ESSA and other things related to the State Board's plan.
First, I guess I'd just like to say thank you for having this sort of tracked approach, which, as you guessed, lines up very well with the way I look at these things as well, so I appreciate that. And I believe the co-chair has a question.
Thank you, and thank you very much. So in terms of feedback, I also agree with a differentiated approach. However, you know, I think it's, there are two things that I think about when you talk about this particular slide and concept. Given our limited resources, your limited resources at the department, it makes great sense to focus very, you know, clearly on those districts that need the most attention. So I agree with you on that. And I like the idea of interdisciplinary teams. I think that makes a lot of sense. I worry about two things. If we pull back in terms of resources, support, guidance, and whatnot on our alliance districts, as a result of having to take a little bit more and saying, okay, these are our 10 most struggling districts. We're going to start to move things over there. I'm concerned about that because, as you know, we've allocated a lot of extra dollars to Alliance districts. They have plans that have to go with that. We know that we haven't had the benchmarks with our Alliance districts to be able to say, yes, we're seeing the needle move. When I went back and independently went through all of those plans and try to figure out, is this district really using those Alliance dollars? Are they really making improvements? You can't really, it's very difficult to really figure out, are those dollars going where they're supposed to go, and are they really making a difference? So I'm very concerned that we are going to be moving resources into those 10 most needy districts, although I agree with the concept. But at the same time, we've got a whole bunch of dollars going to the rest of these Alliance districts, and I don't know if we can afford or how we figure out, or I just caution you, mm-hmm. we need guidance, we need accountability there. I think that and we need more, not less. So and I realize you are balancing a lack of resources all around. So I get your thinking, and I agree with it. I just think that we may be, you know, I'm concerned about actually seeing improvement and changes that, okay, we're focusing on this, we're now seeing improvement. Mm-hmm. At the same time, those Alliance dollars, we know some of them have gone to operating expenses and other places. They have not gone to actually improving the things that we were talking about. And everybody's trying to do the best they can with limited resources. So that's not mm-hmm. to point fingers at anybody or any district, but just a recognition of where we really are and how are we going to make this happen. So I wonder your thoughts on how do we really make sure that the dollars we're doing and the focus that we are showing is actually going to show improvements.
Now that's a really important question. And one of the things that we've learned through, at this point, a little over 5 years mm-hmm. of the work with the Alliance districts is we're starting to really understand which state actions make the most difference at the local level. One of the areas where we have a lot of leverage is on budgets. You know, so I think budget approval would be really important in for both of the categories. Well, and to some degree, currently Title I budgets are all approved anyway.
But do you mean overall budget, Board of Ed budget, or budget for that particular?
I was referring to the federal funds, since the ESSA plan is about the federal funds. So the budget component is a critical component of that because it really helps you understand where they're spending. One of the areas that we seek to make an improvement operationally at the department related to federal funds is in the application process. Currently, we're the only state that doesn't have an electronic grant submission process for federal funds. We used to have another state in that
our
place with
in
us.
Louisiana.
In Mississippi. Was Mississippi.
Oh,
yep,
Mississippi, right.
But they got ahead of us. And I know.
But there's good news here. Good news.
Yeah. It's not usually the race we're in. But we have been able, because of all of the great investment that's been made on the federal level in the last 8 years with Race to the Top and other things, there's a lot of things that were developed with federal funds through grants in other states that are open source. And we are making progress on getting an electronic grant submission approval system. One of the reasons that is connected to your question and matters so much is holding people accountable for what's going on requires being able to see it. And if you deliver your Title I application in three giant boxes, as I used to when I was in Hartford, knowing if I really did what I said I was going to do on page 96, once I got back into the district, was really hard. And so this is a really critical improvement for us. It's going to make our work more efficient. It's going to make us be able to report to our board and to you much more meaningfully about whether the dollars that were devoted to certain things and the resources in terms of the staff's efforts resulted in the action that was originally aligned with the dollars, and if that all resulted in
sort of an academic return on investment.
And I'd like to point out, Senator Slothberg, that this slide does not address funding. So what I heard loud and clear is, are you now going to direct more funding to those 10 districts? And again, because it's formula-based Title I, it's not funding. But it is going to be higher levels of examining what you're saying you're spending your money on. And we do need support to be, it's a hard conversation to be able to say you've used this reading approach for 10 years, and you know, we do believe in local control, but you used it for 10 years and your proficiency rates don't demonstrate it. We have to balance how much we get involved against, you know, and looking at evidence-based and say it's time for a change. And so this is really department resources and department staffing. I don't want you to think that the other alliance districts will get less, because basically what we're proposing with this slide is a federal slash state version of Alliance District Plus for the ed reform districts. So they get everything they received plus. They need more of our attention. They may not always be happy about that, but they're going to get more of our attention, more of our support, and more guidance from us for that. But our other alliance districts will continue. And I do agree with your feedback that we haven't always been able to tell what's working and what's not. One was we were in an assessment data gap. Now, that's not the only game in town, but we had like 3.5-4 years there where we couldn't tell where anybody was on the map. Looking at growth is going to be a huge indicator on your return on investment, educational return on investment, because we're starting to see kids grow.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I have two other areas I just wanted to give you some feedback, or actually one area to give you feedback, and one is a question. So, you know, going back to the discussion about the Title II and where we are going with that, in terms of feedback, you know, I'm a firm believer that the most important thing we can do for any of our kids is put a great teacher in a classroom. And I think we have some really great teachers. And I think we have lots of people who go into teaching because they want to be great teachers. And I do think we have some good teacher prep programs. However, I think we have a very disjointed, disparate, you know, programs that are really not providing enough of what our teachers are going to need to go into those classrooms, especially in those classrooms where there is a significant achievement gap, where there are significant challenges. And I do not think that we are adequately preparing those teachers to go there and to stay there and to be successful. And I don't believe that we are supporting our teachers well enough once they're in the classroom. And it is an area that I think our state really struggles with. I don't see it as something we have focused on. And if we all agree it's the most important thing, it is hard for me to understand why we haven't been focusing on this as saying, and I get it, it takes time to grow great teachers. But we do have some great teachers in the classrooms who are very unsupported. And that needs to be a focus, and that would be, you know, a very, very important piece of this pie, and knowing that what we're doing is not an experiment. There are great programs out there that have proven track records, but it's a conversation that we need to have together about how we move this forward, and we can't just be going, you know, oh, well, this one sounds good, let's go there, and let's add this, and let's add that. There needs to be a much more comprehensive plan for how we are educating and supporting our teachers in this state. So that's my feedback on that. One piece in this whole discussion that has not come up that concerns me greatly is, and I give you great credit for sort of seeing what was happening at the federal level, really digging in, becoming experts in that, and I'm proud of the work that you've done in that area. Having said that as well, though, looking forward, there is some discussion with a new administration that Title I funds to the tune of $15 to $20 billion will be diverted from this account to other areas. If that were the case, what are we doing to sort of have a contingency plan? This would be incredibly devastating to our state and to our neediest districts.
Have we had some, I don't want to jump the gun because it's all, everything's new. Mm-hmm. But if this were to happen, we need a plan.
I think you're raising, you know, I think the big unknown question. Because we, knowing one of the reasons that the timeline toward the ESSA plans for the state agencies was so accelerated was because the reauthorization came so close to administration change. So we've been, all states have been just on an all ESSA all the time treadmill to learn what the new rules would be and to try to figure out what that would mean for our state and get stakeholder feedback and do all these things at once. We all anticipated that administration change would mean some adjustments, and we don't know what adjustments yet. One of the things that the U.S. Department of Education began to do a few months ago was to stop promulgating regulations in anticipation of administration change. So there are some aspects of ESSA where the regulation process will not be resumed until the new USED is fully formed and has their priorities and their staff on. Having said that, one of the things that is true, even when there are very dramatic changes, is that the checks and balances of so much of this being owned by Congress is also a safeguard, and I think it's a time to express what it would mean to Connecticut, you know, as loudly as possible to our delegation. It's certainly big changes in regulation at this point are unlikely in the Title I component, but changes in the funding allocation would be a huge concern because they did pretty much finish with the Title I regulation, but the funding amount that runs through them being reduced would be a huge concern.
Yes, so I think your comment about this would be a good time to let people know. I think it'd be very helpful to hear from you in regards to if we're getting $115 million now, if somehow that number was significantly reduced, what would that really look like in our districts here in the state? So if you can help us really understand that, I think that would be very useful and very timely.
And with some illustrative examples by district or by, you know, this is what it would mean for a large district, this is what it would mean, would be helpful? Okay.
Yes, yeah, so anything you can provide us with, good. I think it would be very helpful. It's very, you know, very concerning when you start to hear things along mm-hmm. those lines. So those are all my questions. Again, thank you for all of your great work. We appreciate it and continue to look forward to working with you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Curry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. The Senator just spoke about supporting teachers and that being one of the most important pieces of the pie, but I think there's a slice of that pie that I don't think we've actually talked about or covered at all. And I know Section E within Title IV talks about family engagement and really earmarking money for that. So are you able to kind of elaborate on what the state may plan to do as far as those statewide family engagement offices?
Mm-hmm. We do have a family engagement staff person who actually has a national reputation. So we actually do have a pretty robust office that works on training school districts, training school staff to sensitively and appropriately engage parents. Because the days when, you know, my parents went to a PTA meeting and that's how you went, times have changed. We have to meet parents in different places, and we have to meet parents in different ways. And I failed to mention, it wasn't my talking points, but I was moving quickly. Family engagement can be funded under Title I as well, especially if you can draw a line between how you're improving a basic program by getting parents more involved. That includes math experiences for parents, all kinds of things. There's wonderful examples happening in the state around engaging non-English speaking parents with early reading with their children, and it can be in any language. We promote it among that through our K-3 reading initiative. So we have several state efforts. We don't have, again, because our basic philosophy is to provide guidance on how you spend that money. in those guidance documents is where we promote that to our districts and also provide them with the evidence-based approaches. Because sometimes if you haven't studied the topic, and who knew that was like an entire separate area of study and great interest, we can point districts now towards really viable, really culturally sensitive, really appropriate programs. And so that's the approach, and I appreciate you bringing that up because I didn't go into that in much depth. But that's how we hope to promote it across the state, is through the guidance documents we'll be creating.
And I think for local districts, knowing that it's an allowable expense is huge, but then the next part is for us to highlight best practices in what you can do with it now that you can. So that's a key role of the state as well. In terms of whether we would go to closer to the maximum holdbacks that the state has allowed, the state is allowed to reserve certain percentages in each of the titles for administrative purposes. We reserve less than we're allowed currently. Some of those reserves are allowed to be larger under ESSA. So in terms of statewide centers, that is, you know, if that's feedback that you want to give us, that we'll capture that. We have someone taking notes today, but also in the survey, that's good feedback for us. And we're digging into all the stakeholder feedback to really see in places where people are asking for the state to do more, the balance there is that in order to do more, we'd have to hold back more money from the LEAs. And so there's that balance, and you know, and that's a tough call.
No, I appreciate that answer, and I would just ask moving forward that when we are having these conversations about some of these changes, that we just make sure that we absolutely talk about family engagement and make that a key priority.
Thank you.
And
I just want to take one quick moment. We did not go into great detail about our stakeholder engagement process, but if I could share with you, the commissioner's done a lot of roundtables. Because we are doing sort of a double dose of stakeholder engagement, so I don't want you to think we came with this awesome plan we think we have and we didn't talk to any folks. We have the skeleton of our plan, and we have not written a word of our state plan, and that is genuinely true. We've partnered with the RESCs, and we're doing focus groups. The commissioner did mention that around. Did you mention that around ESSA or around the board plan?
Both.
It's really active and happening now. We're doing it in translated groups for parents. We're really focusing. We didn't have enough parents involved for our board plan, so we're really redoubling our efforts. We will be posting our plan hopefully in the month of February or March, probably closer to March, which will collect the feedback. So we'll introduce, if we hear loud and clear trends that people are saying, we want you to do this, that will be included in the plan. And then the feedback following, when we post it for a month on the website and make it, you know, possible that everyone sees it before submission. So we really see we're doing, and in fact, we were invited to do a webinar on stakeholder engagement. Who knew? But the CCSSO, our state,
the Council of Chief State School Officers.
Thank you.
Like our
professional organization.
Yeah,
asked us to do a webinar because they were impressed with our approach that we're doing both the front end and after. A lot of states have gone out and tried to educate everyone about ESSA, but then forgot to ask a lot of questions, so they weren't getting enough feedback. They were just educating people. We've really focused on using webinars and such and meetings like this to get into the weeds when it's appropriate with the different stakeholder groups. We have over 80 stakeholder groups we're in contact with.
And so in that way, we feel like between that and all of the great feedback we got leading up to the development of the state board's plan, we can put something forward for comment to everyone that really reflects the views of Connecticut citizens, and rather than just put up a plan and say, see what you think, which is what most states are doing. So while we're excited about the recognition, we're just more excited that it means, you know, that we might be doing a good job of hearing people, and that really is our goal.
Good. Thank you. Representative Johnson. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you again for your great presentation. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the disparities between the different districts and the disparities in the different types of funding. And also, when you take a look at our state, you have state and districts that have a huge amount of wealth and other districts that don't have very much at all. And then trying to line that up with also everywhere you look, it's a very small state with a huge range of just about everything in it. So my concern, of course, is, again, with the district that I represent, Wyndham. And I know that some of the things that we look at in Wyndham are the fact that we have a 3% homeless rate in the district, the highest rate of students who have a home language that isn't English that we just talked about. And we have real problems in terms of trying to get everybody working together. And you've been great in terms of offering assistance to the district in the past. And I think the district is really performing much, much better than it has since I've been here. So I'm very pleased with the great gains that we've made. Nevertheless, and I'm pleased to see that you're looking at trauma-informed practices for teachers, I'm wondering how the evaluation system goes in terms of trying to make sure that we equalize access to education for all the districts, given the huge disparities between all the different districts and the huge different needs that we have. And one way that we do that, I think, is with our wraparound services that we give to the schools in the form of before and after school programs, and also I'm wondering just how we're making evaluations now with respect to trauma-informed practices of our educators. And then finally, going back again to the bilingual education issue, is there a way of testing students who are learning two languages at the same time in a different way than perhaps when we're testing our monolingual students?
Well, you have a lot of good questions. And I think that in terms of the funding questions, there will, I think, be a lot of discussion around funding during the session. So we will definitely work to be as prepared as possible so that we can provide good information to the General Assembly and also to just be knowledgeable enough. So we'll get more information to your earlier question around how things are determined. In terms of our students whose first language is other than English, one of our state assessments offers a tremendous amount of accommodation within it. Because the Smarter Balanced Assessment is delivered online, it has the capacity to translate words that don't change the construct of the question being asked into the student's language. So there's a couple of different ways it can do that. It also has a voice-to-text available, and a host of other accommodations. So our current testing system in the elementary schools is highly supportive of seeing whether or not our kids whose first language is different than English are learning the concepts that they are supposed to be learning in school in mathematics and in reading, English language arts and writing. Connecticut was also at the forefront recently of pushing for English learner accommodations on the high school assessment when we made the move to the SAT assessment. And, we were described as relentless, perhaps, on that. But it was for the good of our kids because we were determined. Connecticut's always been very progressive on accommodations. And in Connecticut, we understand that leveling the playing field so that a kid can actually understand what they're being asked is not the same as giving them an unfair advantage. And we are very progressive about that compared to other states. So going to this high school test with the SAT that's shared with a lot of other states, we had sort of an uphill battle to explain that concept, that an accommodation is not the same as giving a kid an unfair advantage. And we also just were determined that our Connecticut kids were going to get every accommodation they've always gotten in Connecticut, particularly our English learners and our students with disabilities, but it was our English learners where the accommodations were harder to convince the College Board about. We were able not only to get all of our accommodations, but in all but a couple of specific accommodations to get college reportable scores for our kids. And that was a landmark moment for kids, and we're very proud of that. Now the SAT is actually moving in that direction in the near future for all kids, not just Connecticut's kids, because a lot of other states then said, how come Connecticut got that? You know, so we apparently hadn't shared as quickly as we needed to with some of our colleagues, but we're really proud that that's now affecting kids in other states as well. And they've agreed to study with us the effect of the two outlier accommodations that they were unwilling to grant college reportable scores initially on. And which ones
and
are
the
those?
The two are, and we're hopeful that this year we will have bilingual dictionaries as first of all, it is an accommodation, but use of that would still result in a college reportable score, which is our ultimate goal. And the next one and the biggest nut to crack, we're studying together, and to their credit, College Board is looking at and conducting research into scores on this. But we want extended time for bilingual students because we don't believe, although in SAT, and you have to understand, in their commercial side where they're doing Saturday SATs for kids, you have to have a disability to get extended time. We see that as a leveling of the playing field and not an undue advantage, as the commissioner said. And we're hopeful that the College Board will be there by not this year, but the following year. Meanwhile, we're working with the state university system to see how they feel about potentially looking at using those scores from students in Connecticut for admission into Connecticut schools. I can't influence everything for SAT, but we're hoping to be able to at least start a conversation with our universities about that.
Currently, let me just ask you a question there, because it's my understanding from someone who I know who is a neuropsychologist. He said that when a student is learning in two languages at the same time, that the processing time is a little bit different. And so there's scientific evidence to the fact that there should be additional time given in these circumstances, or maybe a different type of a test for students who are learning two languages at the same time versus students who are just monolingual. Or maybe we should all just go become bilingual, and then I think that would take care of it. But in Europe they tend to have more than one language all the way from the beginning. I'm wondering, is there any information from Europe with regard to how they evaluate the tests and testing systems?
That's a great question, and I know that recently the National Council of State Legislators that came out with a big report. I'll look to them and to others and see if we can learn like what we're learning from PISA and the other international tests about that. But I do think the issue of the untimed nature of the elementary test has been very positive for a lot of our kids, because the Smarter Balance test is untimed, and I think it takes some of the stress out of that experience for some of our younger kids. And our high school English learners that needed an extended time experience on the SAT, they did still get an SAT score. It was just whether it would be college reportable. And we are, as Ellen said, working with our state universities to try to have a Connecticut way of accepting that until the College Board gets to where they'll remove that asterisk.
We agree with you wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. There is a huge body of research that shows that extra time is not, tipping the scales like someone's getting away with something. It absolutely takes longer to process language if you're an English learner. And so we do see it, and we've said it repeatedly, it's leveling the playing field. It's not tipping the playing field for the English learner. And so we're hoping we can get College Boards probably older than the state of Connecticut for, at least it seems so. We're hopeful we will get to the point that we'll be successful in this approach.
Thank you so much for all your work and your good analysis. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Seeing none, I'd like to say thank you very much for providing us this opportunity to share our feedback with you. And we, as I said before, look forward to continuing to work with you on this. And again, thank you for the preparation and the good work you did to get us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our meeting. We are adjourned.